بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، والصلاة والسلام على رسوله الكريم نبينا محمد وعلى آله وأصحابه أجمعين، أما بعد. Quick recap of our previous session. Last session we discussed which hadith? What's the actual narration itself? Yeah, that's right. Prophet ﷺ said to the person that sought advice from him, don't become angry. And so we said that this the sunnah, it comes with guidelines about this emotion of anger and how to deal with it. So who can remember what are the guidelines that the sunnah comes with as far as this emotion of anger is concerned? Stay away from... So when the Prophet ﷺ said, do not become angry, what does that mean? Does it mean that the actual emotion of anger, you're not allowed to have that? That is natural. That is an emotion that is inescapable. So yes, when the Prophet says, don't become angry, what he means is, don't expose yourself to those means, those avenues, those causes that will lead you to becoming angry. But then the actual anger management program that is outlined in the sunnah consists of steps. Step number one. The tongue and the limbs. Yeah, so that comes, that's in relation to when you're actually angry. But the actual program of how to deal with the anger is two steps. One step is before you ever even get angry. And then the second is when you get angry itself. And that's what you're talking about. So before you even get angry, what's that about? Huh? Adorn yourself, beautify yourself with what? Good characteristics. Like patience, like not being hasty, like being thoughtful and deliberate and so on and so forth. So that is a character that you should develop, obviously prior to becoming angry. It's something that you have to work on. It takes weeks, months, years to develop that character. Once you've developed that type of character, then when you're in a situation where the average Joe might get angry and express his anger, you're not going to get angry though. Why? Because you've already disciplined yourself and cultivated yourself with beautiful characteristics, such that now when you're faced with a situation that would usually get a person angry, you're not getting angry. Why? Because the character, it allows you to not get angry. It allows you not to react to the impulse of anger. So that's before the situation of anger, becoming angry arises. How about now, once the situation of you becoming angry has arisen? How about now, where you are faced, you are put in a circumstance where you are becoming angry. What do you do now? How many things go under this category? Two. Okay, number one. Okay, so we got two. One that's related to the tongue, second that's related to the limbs. So what's the first one? Very good. So the first thing that you do as far as the tongue is concerned, that if you get angry, you say, أَعُوذُ بِاللَّهِ مِنَ الشَّيْطَانِ الرَّجِيمِ. That's the first step. Second step within the category of the tongue. Yes, the second step is that you remain quiet. You don't say anything. Why? Why should you remain quiet? Why should you just... That's right. Because if you open your mouth while you're angry, you might say something that you're going to regret. Because when you're angry, your control over yourself, over your tongue, is weak. It's not strong. And so your tongue, if it's let loose when you're angry, it might end up expressing something that you're later on going to regret. That's as far as your tongue is concerned. How about your physical body? What's the guidelines that have been mentioned in the Sunnah as far as your physical limbs are concerned? If you're still angry after having sat down, then lie down. So the Sunnah teaches us that as far as the limbs are concerned, if you're angry, then sit down. And if you're still angry, then lie down. If it is the case that the anger hasn't subsided after you've been angry, then you need to lie down. After you've sat down, then you need to lie down. Sorry? Allahu a'lam. Allahu a'lam. Allahu a'lam. Tayyib. So that was the 15th hadith, 16th hadith. Today we're going to look at the 17th hadith. This is the hadith of Abu Ya'la Shaddad ibn Aws radiyallahu ta'ala anhu, who said that the Messenger alayhi salatu wasalam said, who's going to read it? Anybody besides the regular people? Anybody besides the regular people? This hadith, Inna Allah kataba. Who can complete the hadith? Inna Allah kataba al-ihsan ala kulli shay. Akmil. فإذا قتلتم فأحسن القتلة ثم وإذا ذبحتم فأحسن الذبحة بعدين لا you got the phone in your hand وليحد أحدكم شفرته وليرح ذبيحته رواه مسلم. This hadith here is divided, its explanation is divided into five parts. Number one, the Messenger says, the hadith, the translation of the hadith being, indeed Allah has prescribed ihsan upon everything. Ihsan, to do things well. Upon everything. So if you kill, then kill well. And if you slaughter, then slaughter well. And let each one of you sharpen his blade, his knife. And let him spare suffering for the thing, the one that he is sacrificing. The thing that he is sacrificing. So part number one. The Messenger says in this hadith, indeed Allah has prescribed ihsan upon everything. Ihsan, to do things well. Perfect things, to do things well. Shaykh Abdul Muhsin, he says, Al-Ihsan Dibbul Isa'ah. Ihsan is the opposite of Isa'ah. Isa'ah, to do things badly. To do things in a bad way. And when the Messenger says, indeed Allah has prescribed Ihsan, this means that Allah has legislated it. And He's made it an obligation. He's made it mandatory. Allah has prescribed ihsan for every single thing. Yani Allah has made ihsan, doing things well and proper, upon every single thing. He's made it obligatory. He's made it mandatory. I.e., it is a religious and legislative obligation. And ihsan, doing things well. It is in reference to doing things well towards humans and doing things well as far as animals are concerned. So your dealing with others is general, applicable to animals and applicable to human beings. This is the first part. Second part is that the Messenger alayhi salatu wasalam, he now gives an example. He gives an example of ihsan. Gives an example of being good, being good, merciful, good and merciful when a person is slaughtering. And that is by a person sharpening the knife, slaughtering an animal, for example. slaughtering an animal, a person should sharpen his knife before he slaughters the animal. Why? Why? Because you're sparing the animal from suffering. If it is the case that you don't sharpen the knife, then that's going to result in what? Suffering towards the animal, and harm towards the animal, and harm that isn't necessary. And therefore that is what? That is isa'a. That is dealing and interacting with that animal, dealing with that animal, behaving towards that animal in a harmful manner, in a bad manner. And therefore, sharpening the knife, the Messenger alayhi salatu wasalam, as an example, he tells us to sharpen our knife when we slaughter the animal. Why? Because that is ihsan, that is being good and kind towards the animal. Third part. In the third part, Shaykh Abdul Muhsin Abad, he makes a quote from Ibn Rajab al-Hanbali rahimahullah in Jami' al-Ulum wal-Hikm. So Ibn Rajab al-Hanbali, he says that this hadith, it indicates the obligation in observing ihsan, in observing goodness, kindness, in observing perfection, in doing things well, in all of the actions. The Messenger alayhi salatu wasalam made an example of ihsan towards animals. Ihsan towards the one that is killed justifiably in an Islamic country at the hands of an Islamic government. For example, capital punishment that occurs, and this capital punishment, it occurs not just in Muslim countries, it occurs in non-Muslim countries as well. So this type of ihsan should be observed towards animals when they are being slaughtered. And likewise, the government and those that are deputized by the government to carry out the capital punishment, they should likewise observe ihsan. They should likewise observe this ihsan when they are implementing that capital punishment. But that's just an example of ihsan, doing things well. But ihsan, it applies in all of one's actions. And it applies as far as the obligations are concerned. So for example, when a person prays salah, the wajibat of that salah, the obligations of that salah, you should perform them well. And that, the fulfillment of that obligation, ihsan in the fulfillment of that obligation, is no doubt wajib, because the action is wajib. In the salah, there are mustahabbat. There are recommended deeds, recommended actions. They're not wajib. Like for example, dua al-istiftah, the opening dua. And likewise, a person raising his hands when he gets up from, he rises from ruku' and so on and so forth. Raf' al-yadain in those situations, they are from the sunan. A person, he does so, then that is his, the perfection of his salah. It is the perfection of his salah. A person should have ihsan when he does those things. He should do those things well. Likewise, in terms of his mu'amalat, his dealing with others, there are those things that when a person engages in, as far as the dealings with others are concerned, it is wajib. Those things that are wajib. For example, loving for your brother, that which you love for yourself, is it something that is mustahab or is it something that is wajib? Wajib. How do you know that? What's the proof? There's a hadith, and what's the wording of the hadith? La yu'minu. None of you truly believes, none of you has iman. Meaning none of you has attained the obligatory perfection of a person's iman, up until he loves for his brother what he loves for himself. So the fact that the Prophet said, La yu'minu, none of you has the obligatory perfection of iman, indicates that as far as your mu'amala with your brother is concerned, loving for him what you love for yourself is wajib. You have to do it. So a person, he should have ihsan in that regard. He should do that well. He should love for his brother that which he loves for himself well. But then you have those other things that are supererogatory, optional. You don't have to do it, But they are the perfections and they are the completions of loving your brother. Like, for example, smiling in the face of your brother. Is it wajib? Do you have to smile in the face of your brother all the time, every time? You don't have to, obviously. But when you do smile in the face of your brother, that is what? That is considered sadaqah. As the Messenger alayhi salatu wasalam, he told us, that to see your brother and to meet your brother with a smiling countenance, with a smiling face, is sadaqah. So when a person does do that, then do it well. You smile in the face of your brother, do it well. Don't do one of those half-hearted smiles. If you want to observe ihsan towards your brother, ihsan, that type of ihsan that is now mustahab, that is supererogatory, do it well. So the point being here is that Ibn Rajab, rahimahullah ta'ala, is saying that ihsan is ihsan in those matters that are obligatory, likewise ihsan in those matters that are mustahab. Doing things well in those matters that are obligatory, and likewise doing well in those matters that are recommended. Tayyib, part number four. Al-ihsan fi al-qatl maqlubun bidun ta'dhib aw tamthil. سواء كان في قتال الكفار أو القتل قصاصا أو حدا. So إحسان, as far as the example that has been mentioned in the hadith, the example that has been mentioned in the hadith is إحسان in killing. إحسان in killing, killing well. And that is something that is sought in all forms of allowed killing. You have the allowed killing, that is the killing of animals, the slaughter of animals. For example, a person slaughters an animal in order to eat it. So a person slaughters it, he should do so with ihsan. Do it well, meaning spare the animal from suffering. Sharpen the knife that he's going to use. That's one type of killing. Another type of killing is the killing of the enemy combatant. You're on a battlefield in a conventional war situation. You have the enemy. In Islam, what is legislated is ihsan, even towards your enemy. This hadith indicates ihsan towards even the enemy that is trying to kill you. So you're a soldier on the battlefield, and based upon this hadith, you're not allowed to start mutilating him. You're not allowed to start giving him a slow, painful, agonizing death. Those people that are fighting you, they might have that intent. Those that might be enemies to you, fighting you on a battlefield in a conventional war situation. We're not talking about us, British citizens revolting against the British government, for example. There is no harm that the British government is doing upon the Muslims of this country anyhow. But we're talking about a conventional war situation. For example, you belong to a Muslim country and you're a soldier enlisted in the army of that Muslim country. The leader of that country has said that you need to go and fight the Khawarij. The Khawarij, those that are represented in our era by people such as ISIS, for example. Now we know that ISIS, they mutilate. We know that ISIS, the way that they kill is not something that is legislated in the Sharia. Slow, painful death. That is not something that is legislated in the Sharia. They might want to kill you like that. You, as per the Sunnah, as a soldier in a Muslim army, for a legitimate government, are not allowed to do the same to them. Rather, you're meant to spare them from painful suffering. Your point is to defend yourself and to kill those that are trying to kill you. But it isn't such that you're meant to mutilate them and harm them. That is as far as the battlefield is concerned. Likewise, the Muslim government, no doubt the Muslim government in a Muslim country, when they carry out their hudud, their corporal punishments and their capital punishments, when they carry out the hudud, those hudud are meant to be carried out with ihsan, with this ihsan that the Messenger alayhi salatu wasalam is commanding us with. So, when it is the case that they execute the one that deserves execution in a Muslim government, with the Muslim authority, they execute him for example, having committed the act of murder, then that execution has to occur with the least amount of pain. Unlike other nations today, who also have capital punishment. But the manner that they adopt is a very slow, agonizing form of execution. For example, the electric chair. A person frying in that chair for long, extended periods of time. Or for example, lethal injection. And other examples that I can't think of from the top of my head. Lethal injection. Electric chair, and so on and so forth. These type of methods of execution, they are not what... That is not generally how the Islamic execution occurs in Muslim countries, as far as capital punishment is concerned. The sword is investigated, it's examined, it's looked at, is it sharp? Is it going to cause suffering to the criminal that is being punished? What are the exemptions? Are there exemptions? Yes. From them is, from what we mentioned before, the stoning of the adulterer or the adulteress. They are stoned to death. But as we mentioned before, Shaykhul Islam Ibn Taymiyyah, he said, nobody since the dawn of Islam until this day of ours, yani until the day of Ibn Taymiyyah, has ever had this punishment executed upon them as a result of four witnesses coming and bearing witness to the act of penetration having occurred. Rather, on the most part, it was as a result of al-i'tiraf, people admitting to have committed the act of adultery themselves. Even though the Islamic law says, better for a person to make tawbah, to repent to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and then do righteous deeds. But the point being, that's one of the exemptions. The stoning of the adulterer or the adulteress. Likewise, the like for like principle. Somebody commits an act of murder and he commits it in a certain way, then there is a punishment whereby he is executed in a similar manner. Or the corporal punishment that is applied upon him is the same type of harm that he did to somebody else. Like in the time of the Messenger alayhi salatu wasalam, when a Jewish man, not to say that all Jews are like this, but there happened to have been a Jewish man who crushed the head of a young woman between two stones. Didn't cause her to die as a result of it, but he hurt her and he caused her to be hurt by crushing her head between two stones. So now, when this man was caught for having committed this crime, then the Messenger alayhi salatu wasalam ordered that this man, his head is also crushed in a similar way. That narration there being recorded in Al-Bukhari wa Muslim. Likewise, the story of the Urniyin, recorded in the two Sahihs of Imam Al-Bukhari wa Muslim. They were a people who embraced Islam. They embraced Islam and the Messenger alayhi salatu wasalam gave them some sheep or some goats, and he also provided them with a shepherd. Later on, these people became ill. Once they had recovered, they ended up apostating from Islam and killing the shepherd of the Messenger alayhi salatu wasalam that he provided them with. So once they were caught and they mutilated the eyes. This is the point. They mutilated the eyes of the shepherd. So therefore the Messenger alayhi salatu wasalam, he applied the same punishment upon them. that before they were executed, he had their eyes mutilated as well. Why? Because they did the same thing to the shepherd. So the general rule, somebody commits an act whereby he is meant to be punished, his hand is meant to be chopped, by a Muslim government. We're not talking about people taking the law into their own hands and being vigilantes. A Muslim government chops the hand of the one who has been convicted of theft. Mercy is meant to be applied. Ihsan is meant to be applied to that criminal. You're not meant to make it a laborious, long, agonizing form of chopping, where it's like you're cutting bread. But rather it's a chop, it's not slice, it's a chop, if you know what I mean. It's not like you cut bread or you cut something else. It's a chop with a sharp sword or a sharp device. Likewise, the execution process. Ihsan is meant to be observed. Goodness and mercy is meant to be observed. And not ta'zeeb, not agonizing, excruciating pain and mutilation. Such that a person ensures that the sword is sharp, or the device is sharp, and that he's spared of any unnecessary suffering. Are there exemptions to it? Yes, there are exemptions. Like, for example, adultery and fornication, adultery. And likewise, when a person commits a certain act of a certain crime, whereby he harms someone else, either by harming them or by killing them, that harm that he did, then it is allowed for the Islamic government to apply the same type of harm to him. So if he mutilated the eyes of someone, then the same thing to him. If he chopped up the arms and the legs of someone, then the same thing to him. Mafhoom? Understood, ikhwan? Tayyib, part number 5 is a summary. So number 1, wujub al-ihsan fi kulli shay, the obligation of ihsan in every single thing. Number 2, the obligation of ihsan when killing in the easiest way by which the blood is going to be spilled, i.e. the one that is the least painful for that particular animal or for that particular person. Number 3, wujub al-ihsan inda dhabh al-haywan, the obligation of ihsan when slaughtering the animal. And number 4, that the device that is used to slaughter is to be examined before it is used. Before you use the knife, before you use that particular device to slaughter, to kill, examine it based upon the hadith of the Messenger alayhi salatu wasalam, and let each one of you sharpen his knife and let him spare the dhabiha from suffering. Can we repeat number 2, please? The obligation of killing in the least painful way. Okay? Tayyib. Hadith number 18. This hadith is a tremendous hadith. Hadith of Abi Dharr, radiallahu ta'ala anhu, likewise the hadith of Mu'adh ibn Jabal, radiallahu ta'ala anhu. I'll start off the hadith, and let's see how many people remember this hadith. اتق الله حيثما اتق الله حيثما كنت, fear Allah wherever you may be. واتبع السيئة الحسنة تمحوها, and follow up an evil deed with a good deed, it will wipe it out. وكثير من الناس, not in this hadith. وخالق الناس بخلق حسن, and interact with people with good manners. Again, اتق الله حيثما كنت, fear Allah, have taqwa of Allah wherever you may be. واتبع السيئة الحسنة تمحوها, and follow up an evil deed with a good deed, it will wipe it away. وخالق الناس بخلق حسن, and follow and interact with people with good manners. This hadith, its explanation is divided into 5 parts. Part number one. هذا الحديث اشتمل بجمله الثلاث على ما هو مطلوب من المسلم لربه ولنفسه ولغيره. This hadith, it consists of that which is required from a Muslim as far as his relationship with his Lord is concerned, as far as his relationship with himself is concerned, and as far as his relationship with others are concerned. This hadith, the ulama, they say, it has combined usul al-mu'amala. It has gathered together the foundations of mu'amala, the foundations of interaction. You either interact with Allah, or you interact with yourself, or you interact with everybody else. So this hadith has gathered together these three things, and it has mentioned how those three mu'amalat should engage in them, how you should engage in those three mu'amalat. Mu'amala with Allah, mu'amala with yourself, and mu'amala with other people, others. This hadith is azim. This hadith, Allah's Messenger alayhi salatu wasalam, he made this statement when he was seeing off Mu'adh ibn Jabal radiallahu ta'ala anhu. Mu'adh ibn Jabal radiallahu ta'ala anhu, he is now about to set off on a journey. To where? To Yemen. In order to preach, to give da'wah, to teach. So now he's going off on a journey. And thus the Messenger alayhi salatu wasalam advises him. And he advises him with these three things. And look at how jami', how comprehensive, how all-inclusive this statement of the Messenger is. Mu'adh ibn Jabal is going off on a journey, and thus he's going to interact. He's going to interact on his journey with Allah, no doubt, with himself and with other people. He's going to engage in all three. And therefore the Messenger alayhi salatu wasalam is giving him advice that is relevant to all of those three forms of interaction. So the first form of advice that he says to him is اتق الله حيث ما كنت. اتق الله, wherever you are. Have taqwa of Allah wherever you are. At-taqwa, linguistically, is أن يجعل بينه وبين الذي يخافه وقاية تقيه منه. At-taqwa, linguistically, in the Arabic language, literally means this. That you place between yourself and the thing that you fear a barrier. That you place between yourself and the thing that you fear a barrier that is going to protect you from the thing that you fear. Who can repeat the definition of taqwa, linguistic definition of taqwa? Put your hand up. Put your hand up if you can repeat the definition of taqwa, the linguistic definition of taqwa. Did you raise your hand, yeah? Fadal akhi. To place, excellent, you've got to start it. To place, yeah? To place a barrier between yourself and the one you fear, or the thing that you fear. The thing that you fear. Very good. Anybody else? So that everybody goes home having memorized the linguistic meaning of taqwa. Ah, that's naqis, akhi, afwa. That's deficient now. He nailed it on the head. We didn't say that, huh? To place a barrier between yourself and the thing that you fear, so that it protects you from the thing that you fear. It protects you from the thing that you fear. That's what it linguistically means. That is what it linguistically means. مثل اتخاذ النعال والخفاف للوقاية مما يكون في الأرض من ضرر. Such as using نعال, يعني sandals and خفاف يعني socks as a wiqaya, as a protection from the thing that may harm your feet on the ground. So now when a person, he is putting on sandals, putting on good strong socks, he is using them as a form of taqwa, as a form of, as a barrier that is placed to prevent the things on the ground harming his feet. There are harmful things on the ground, pebbles, stones, glass, things like this, sharp toys for example, or sharp things. You put on your sandals, why? Because those sandals are going to tattaqika, they're going to be a taqwa for you, a barrier for you, a barrier that you've placed between you and the thing that you fear. What's the thing that you fear? Stones. What's the thing that you fear? Dirt and filth. You fear that, you don't want that to touch your feet, so you put the sandals, you put the shoes, you put the socks there to be a wiqaya, a barrier between you and between the thing that you fear, to protect you from being harmed by those things. Does that example make the linguistic meaning of taqwa clear? Tamam. So now as far as the sharia is concerned, that is, أن يجعل الإنسان بينه وبين غضب الله وقاية تقيه منه. What's the thing that you fear? Now we're talking in the Islamic sense of the word. What's the thing that you're scared of? What's the thing that you fear? Allah, and more specifically, the عذاب of Allah, the عقاب of Allah, the punishment of Allah, the penalty of Allah. That's the thing that you fear. You fear Jahannam. You fear عذاب القبر. You fear the ghusas of Yawm al-Qiyamah, the horrors of Yawm al-Qiyamah. So the azab of Allah is what you fear. And therefore you want to place a barrier between yourself and the azab of Allah. And this barrier is gonna protect you from the azab of Allah. It's gonna prevent the azab of Allah from reaching you. So what is this barrier that you place? How do you place this barrier? What does this barrier consist of? This barrier that is going to prevent the azab of Allah, or is going to protect you from the azab of Allah. What is this barrier that is going to protect you from the azab of Allah? What is this taqwa essentially? Ibadah, very good. Could you elaborate upon that a bit more? Worship, yeah. The worship that you do, that makes Allah pleased, yes. Yes, that's very good. So basically doing those good deeds that Allah is pleased with. And what else? Very good. MashaAllah, barakallahu feek. Staying away from those things that will bring about Allah's anger against you. Yeah. Mannerisms, that is part and parcel of it, yeah. Istighfar, yeah, that's part and parcel of it. Knowing Allah is watching you, that goes inside of it. نعم بس هذا يعتبر من المراقبة. هذا يعتبر من الإحسان. يدخل من يعني في باب العبادة. بس نحن الآن نتحدث عن تعريف العبادة, تعريف التقوى. Taqwa, what is it defined as? One of the tabi'een by the name of Talq ibn Habib. This tabi'i, he defined taqwa. And it is the following. That you obey Allah, just as Ridwan said. Just as Ridwan said, that it is doing those things that make Allah pleased with you. So Talq ibn Habib, he says that you fulfill the obligations, you fulfill the commands, fulfill the obligations, or fulfill the commands. Ala nurin min Allah, upon light from Allah, upon nur from Allah, meaning upon iman. So you obey Allah, you do those things that Allah told you to do. You pray, for example, ala nurin min Allah. What's the thing that's making you pray? Nur from Allah. What's this nur? Yani iman. Iman in Allah has made you pray. hoping in the reward of Allah. That's one part of the definition. There's two parts to it. That's one part. That you أن تعمل بأوامر الله على نور من الله رجاء ثواب الله. أن تعمل على أوامر الله على نور من الله رجاء ثواب الله. That you fulfill the commands of Allah, act upon the commands of Allah, upon nur from Allah, meaning upon iman. You're not doing it just because it's a habit, you're not doing it just because it's a culture, you're doing it out of iman, knowing that this is an act that Allah will reward me for if I'm mukhlis, and it's in accordance with the sunnah. And you do so out of hope in the reward of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Going to come in 2 seconds. The meaning of the second part of the definition is that you leave that which Allah has prohibited you from. You leave that which Allah has prohibited you from. عَلَى نُورٍ مِّنَ اللَّهِ. Upon light from Allah. مَخَافَةَ عَذَابِ اللَّهِ. Out of fear of the عذاب of Allah. أَن تَجْتَنِبْ مِّن نَوَاهِ اللَّهِ. أن تجتنب من نواهي الله على نور من الله مخافة عذاب الله. That's the second part. That you keep away. So why are we saying this? Why are we talking about this definition? Because we're talking about a barrier that we need to set up between us and عذاب القبر. We're talking about a barrier that we need to set up between us and the horrors and the fright and the terror and the punishment of Yawm al-Qiyamah. We're talking about a barrier that we need to set up between us and Jahannam. So what is that barrier? Physically, what does that barrier look like? Physically, I mean, how do we implement that barrier? What do we need to do in order to have that barrier? We need to do this. This thing that Talq ibn Habib mentioned. This thing that Shaykh Ridwan summarized for us. To obey Allah out of iman, hoping in the reward of Allah. To keep away from the muharramat, those things that Allah has prohibited. Out of iman, fearing the azab of Allah. This is basically taqwa. This is basically ماذا? Taqwa. So the Messenger alayhi salatu was salam, he says to Mu'adh ibn Jabal radiallahu ta'ala anhu, اتَّقِ اللَّهِ حَيْثُ مَا كُنْتَ. Have this taqwa of Allah, wherever you are. And how relevant it is. Taqwa of Allah, wherever you are. Whether it is the case that you are on land, whether it is the case that you're on at sea, on a ship, whether it's the case that you're up in the air, flying in altitude in an aeroplane. Regardless of where you are, whether you're a muqeem, a resident in your hometown, or whether you're a musafir, someone that is traveling, have taqwa of Allah wherever you are. And how relevant it is that this advice is given when a person is going on a journey, as the ulama they mention. Why is it so relevant? What's so significant about when a person goes on a journey? Why should, when you give advice to somebody, when they're going on a journey, why is it the case that taqwa is telling him to have taqwa of Allah wherever he's going to be? Why is it so relevant when a person is going on a journey? Obviously have taqwa of Allah wherever you are. But why is it very relevant when a person is going on a journey? Sorry? He might not come back. But you might not live to see tomorrow, even if you're muqeem, even if you're resident. There's something that is quite significant about when you're going to go on a journey. He's going to come across things that he's never come across before, in the right direction. If he lives in Bolton, he knows what's expected. But if he goes out of his town, meet different people, circumstances that might arise that he's not used to, and he might act out of character. Okay, I can see what you're saying, but I'm trying to get something else. He might be influenced differently, that's similar to what the brother mentioned. Yeah, basically that. If you're going to be somewhere that isn't your hometown, nobody knows you there. And thus you might find, generally speaking, a person, he's away from home, he goes to a different town, far from Lancashire, he goes to, I don't know, Dorset or Gloucestershire or somewhere where most likely no one's going to really know you. He goes to the Shetland Islands or somewhere like that. No one's really going to know you there. So there your guard might drop. And people might start behaving in a way that is different to how he usually behaves when he's at home. In Bolton, in Nelson, in Lancashire, in Yorkshire. Different. Why? Because no one's there to take him to account, as Adam said. When you're outside in a different town, maybe your guard might drop. And your akhlaq and your adab and the way that you conduct yourself isn't the same as it is back home. Back home in town, everybody knows you. So, mashallah, well-mannered person, respectable, very patient, very well-mannered. Now you're on a journey and you've gone to, I don't know, John O'Groats, for example, up in the north. And there's nobody there, just a few tourists. Some of the tourists, you get into some type of, I don't know, confrontation with them, and you start acting in a way that you don't usually do. Or you're up at some service station somewhere in Glasgow, for example. You're at some service station, and the person shortchanges you at the service station. Next thing you know, you start, you know, getting angry. What are you doing? Shortchange me? Do you know who I am? And all these type of things. You'd never ever do that in Bolton. Why? Because everybody will say, look, this is your adab, this is your akhlaq, and so on and so forth. So that's why it's very, very relevant that when a person is going on a journey, he advises, or he's advised, about having taqwa of Allah, having fear of Allah, wherever you're going to be. You're going to be somewhere where people aren't going to pull you up. You're going to be in a place where you know if you mess up, it's only going to be for a day or two, and then you're going to come back home, no one's ever going to know. For fear of Allah, even when you're there and nobody knows you. Why? Because I think as the brother mentioned, or one of the brothers mentioned, just because nobody else is watching you, it does not mean that Allah isn't watching you. Allah is watching you wherever you are. And therefore the ulama, they say, the best wa'il and the best zajir, a'zamul, يعني the best admonisher, and the best thing that يعني يزجرك, it causes you, the best admonisher and the best thing that will hold you back and prevent you from doing those things that you shouldn't be doing is what? Muraqabah of Allah. Being conscious that Allah is watching you. I think one of the brothers in the back mentioned it, that brother there. You mentioned it, didn't you? Being conscious of the fact that Allah is watching you, that is the best wa'ir and the best zajir, the best admonisher, and the best thing that will يعني يزجرك. It's going to caution you, and it's going to you know, if you make a mistake, it's going to say, hey, fix yourself up, fix yourself up. The best wa'ir and the best zajir is muraqabah of Allah. Yes, certain khutbahs, certain sermons, certain lectures, certain books, certain company. They are nice reminders and they are nice admonishes. But the best one, better than any khutbah, better than any book, better than anything, is what? Muraqabah of Allah. You have to obviously concentrate, you have to think about it. Allah is actually watching me right now. Right now, if nobody is here, Allah is actually seeing me and He's close to me. He sees me, He's here, He hears me. He, Jalla wa'ala, who is above His arsh. That is the best wa'id and that is the best tajir. So when a person bears that in mind, then if he goes off on a journey, and he's by himself, and he's in, wherever it may be, by himself, in a hotel, in up in the highlands, for example. Nobody knows him. Very likely he's going to meet somebody that knows him. He's in a hotel, or he's out in the streets with the tourists and what have you. The best wa'id that he can have, and the best zajah that he can have, is muraqabah of Allah, being conscious that Allah is seeing him, hearing him right now. So that is why this particular advice is very, 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 very relevant in all situations and in all cases, specifically when a person is going on a journey. So I think we'll conclude at this particular point. So unless something needs to be clarified, repeated, corrected, then we'll close now. Nothing? You're going to ask something. Yeah. So the Messiah alayhi salatu wasalam, he said, taqwa hahuna, taqwa hahuna, taqwa hahuna. Piety is here, piety is here, piety is here. He's pointing towards his heart, meaning the foundation, the asl, the root, from where taqwa branches forth from is the heart. It isn't the case that what is required for you is taqwa sina'i, artificial taqwa, just in the exterior. No. The root of it and the foundation of it is in the heart, but if it's in the heart, then it is obviously going to manifest itself upon the tongue and on the limbs. And that's why the Messenger alayhi salatu wasalam, he said, أَلَا وَإِنَّ فِي الْجَسَدِ مُضْغَةً إِذَا صَلُحَتْ صَلُحَ الْجَسَدُ كُلُّهُ وَإِذَا فَسَدَتْ فَسَدَ الْجَسَدُ كُلُّهُ أَلَا وَهِيَ الْقَلْبُ. Indeed, in the body there is a morsel of flesh, a piece of flesh. If it is sound, and the whole body is sound, and if it is corrupt, and the whole body is corrupt, he said, indeed it is the heart. So if the heart has taqwa, then yes, it will become manifest upon the limbs and upon the tongue. If the heart is devoid of it, then you're not going to find true taqwa being manifest upon the tongue and upon the limbs. So unless anything needs to be corrected or clarified or asked, Sheikh Ridwan. Fearing Allah when he's on a journey. Okay. Should we ask everybody else? Let's see who's been listening. So Shaykh Ridwan, he said, could you give a brief explanation as to why it is so significant for a person to have taqwa of Allah when he's traveling? So who would like to give us a brief summary on that? I think everybody has been listening, but maybe it's a bit too much for them. Khalas. Would you like to give one? Do you know the answer? No? Okay, I thought maybe you're asking for the benefit of others. Ammar, want to have a go? Why is it so significant that when a person's traveling, he should have taqwa of Allah? He should have taqwa of Allah in all cases, in all scenarios, in all situations, even when you're resident at home. What's so significant about having taqwa of Allah when you're away from home, when you're traveling? Sheikh Abu al-Harith. So when you're at home, there's people that what was the word that you said? Take you to account, right? They'll pull you up. Say, hey, don't do that. Allah's watching. Don't do that. Right? They'll pull you up. However, when you travel, you may go to a place where nobody knows you. And it's easy to drop your guard and start becoming lackadaisical. Therefore, it's important when you're traveling that you're conscious that Allah is watching you, that you need to put a barrier in front of you and the adab of Allah by doing the good things and keeping away from the bad things. Is that okay? By what, sorry? Giving up a certain sin. Because he hasn't really understood the hadith. Knowledge of the text of the Sharia do not work by taking a text in isolation. That's what that person is doing. He's taking that particular text where the messenger says, taqwa is here. Taqwa is here. And the messenger was pointed to his heart. Rather, there is a principle from ulum al-hadith called jam', harmonization of texts. So all the texts have to be harmonized on that particular topic in order to arrive at conclusive understanding. And so therefore, that narration about taqwa hahuna, taqwa is here in the heart, is combined with the other hadith that we covered before, the fourth hadith, that indeed in the heart, indeed in the body is a piece of flesh. If it is sound, then the whole body is sound. If it is corrupt, then the whole body is corrupt. Indeed it is the heart. So the Prophet ﷺ, he himself is telling us that if taqwa is in the heart, then the rest of the body is going to be sound. If the heart is corrupt and the taqwa in the heart is lacking, or it's deficient, or it's absent, then that is going to become manifest upon the limbs and upon the tongue. So the person, what he's done there, his error is that he has taken a hadith in isolation. And he hasn't looked at what the scholars have said concerning the topic. It's the scholars that are able to get those other narrations that are related to the topic, harmonize them, and then draw conclusions from it. A general joke can't just draw a conclusion by just taking one hadith. The what, sorry? Oh, yeah. Allah alam, in that particular circumstance, in that particular narration, in general, capital punishment will not be applied to somebody that doesn't deserve it. So if it is the case that, because you have to remember, they did another crime as well, which was apostasy, which in an Islamic country does warrant the death penalty. But I don't know as to whether or not every single one of those people that belong to that tribe killed the shepherd, or if it was just a few of them. However, we do know that all of them committed a crime that does warrant the death penalty in an Islamic country. Apostasy, yeah. Say that again, sorry. So the shams, yeah. Allah, I can't comment upon that. I don't know. Yeah. But as far as the judicial law is concerned, that's obviously only applicable to the one that is convicted of that particular crime. Does Allah punish a people who aren't engaged in a certain sin? Yes. Because of the fact that they didn't enjoin the good and forbid the evil. So there's a certain nation, among them are a people who commit a certain crime. Allah sends down a specific punishment for that specific crime. But those people that didn't engage in that crime, they're also punished. Why? Because they did not enjoin the good and forbid the evil concerning that crime. Don't know if that helps. Yeah. Sheikh Farooq, does that answer your question? Yes. Allah A'lam, if it's something that is meant to be set in stone for every single traveler. Is it from the sunnah that every single person that goes on journey, you have to say this? Is that what your question is? Allahu a'lam. I don't know that to be the case. Generally the ulama, they say, it is nice, it is good, they use these type of terms. It is nice, it is good, how appropriate it is for a person to say this. Is it the case that you have to say that before a person goes on a journey? Allahu a'lam. Is that what your question is in reference to? Allahu a'lam. The ulama, they say, it is good. It is, they use those type of terms. It is good. How appropriate, how befitting, how nice, how beautiful it is for a person to give this type of advice to someone that is traveling. Is it the case that it needs to be set in stone, that every single person that goes on journey, you have to say this? Allahu a'lam. I don't know. Okay. Anything else? أيوة. الدعاء يكون أيوة. ما السؤال؟ في سؤال في التعليق. لا المراد the brother is asking that why is it the case that a person has to be more pious and have more taqwa when he's traveling. المراد ليس بأنه يجب على الشخص أن يكون أكثر متقيا عندما يكون مسافرا, بس بأن الأسباب التي يتعرض الشخص يعني إليها عندما يكون مسافرا, الأسباب التي يؤدي إلى يعني المعاصي والمحرمات, الأسباب تكون أكثر. ليش؟ لأن ما فيش مراقبة من الناس, ما فيش أحد يقول يا أخي انتبه لا تفعل كذا, يا أخي انتبه الله يراك, ما في أحد, لأنك يعني ربما تكون وحيدا أو تكون بعيدا عن الإخوة وعن الأصحاب. كيف؟ المانع هو الخوف من المراقبة من الله, هو المانع يعني الأساسي. فاهم؟ كيف؟ عندما تكون يعني عندما يخلو الإنسان بنفسه, فيعني لابد أن يكون مراقبة, لابد أن يكون مراقبة الله عز وجل في ذلك الحال أكثر. لماذا؟ لأن ما في أصحاب يعني يزجره, ما في أصحاب ينهاه عن يعني عن ارتكاب المعاصي. عرفت؟ خلاص. So the brother is basically asking, why is it the case that the person, he is meant to have more taqwa? It's not the case that you're meant to have more taqwa when you're traveling, but it's just that the causes and the means of you falling to sin might be more, and that you're more exposed to those things that might make you a bit more heedless concerning Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Because you don't have your friends around you, you don't have your people around you, and you're exposed to environments where, as the brother mentioned before, that you're not used to. Perhaps you might be in a situation whereby you might not be as observant as you would be when you're in your homeland. And therefore, as a result of that, when you're by yourself, away from people, away from those people that are going to reprimand you, away from those people that are going to censure you, away from those people that are going to say, my brother, don't do such and such, Allah's watching, you're away from them. Now those means and those causes that might lead you to sinning, they're more so. And therefore a person, it is appropriate that he is advised when he's traveling to have taqwa of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Anything else? خلاص يا سعد الله يخليك. بارك الله فيكم وصلى الله على نبينا محمد والحمد لله رب العالمين.